Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where I ask my guest to tell me the 5 things from their life that they would like to preserve in a time capsule. They can pick 4 things that they love or cherish, but they must also pick 1 thing that they loathe, something they'd like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in episode 118 of My Time Capsule is the stand-up comedian Angela Barnes, who, following her degree at Sussex University, ran comedy nights in Brighton, where, finally, in 2008, she decided to have a go herself. She did a 12-week workshop on stand-up comedy, the same course that our guest Sean Walsh attended, actually, and then began her stage career, performing at Latitude and the Edinburgh Festival, and winning BBC Radio 2's New Comedy Award. She became a regular on the comedy circuit and started writing the scripts for the hosts of the News Quiz. After appearing on the topical shows Stand Up for the Week and The Now Show, she became host of News Jack on Radio 4 Extra, and then finally got a chance to say the words she'd written herself as the host of the News Quiz. Angela has appeared on Dave's As Yet Untitled and is a regular panellist on the topical comedy show Mock the Week with Hugh Dennis and Dara O'Brien. She was named the hardest working stand-up in 2018, having driven 30,000 miles to 91 different venues where she performed over 100 shows. She also makes her own show, You Can't Take It With You, for BBC Radio 4 and the less than serious history podcast We Are History with John O'Farrell. So you can imagine how grateful I was when Angela agreed to spare some of her rather rare free time to tell me the 5 things she'd like to put in her time capsule. And this is what she chose. Though every person I've ever known is called Angela, they never get called Angela.
Never. Very rarely. I'm Barnsley, Angie, Ange, or you. I'll respond to anything. I'm not fussy.
Okay. In that case, Kevin.
Yeah. Don't push it.
Go mad. All right, Angie, we're going to talk about some things you want to put into a time capsule.
Yes.
So should we start?
Let's start. I'm excited about this.
Brilliant.
So number one that I want to put in the time capsule is a radio tuned to Radio 4. Now, originally, I was going to say I want to put the Archers in there because I'm a lifelong fan of the Archers. I love the Archers. People don't expect that of me necessarily, but I was brought up listening to it with my mum and I have to listen to The Archers every day. Like, I used to say it's like getting a 15-minute hug, and then somebody pointed out that actually a 15-minute hug's a bit creepy. So maybe not that. But then I thought, actually, no, it's not just The Archers, is it? It's everything around it. It's like I listen to The Archers, but then I leave the radio on and I listen to Front Row. And then, you know, obviously I listen to the comedy before The Archers, and I grew up listening to the News Quiz. And that's how I, you know, sort of got obsessed with comedy, was through Radio 4. So I thought, no, it's the whole shebang. I want Radio 4 in the time capsule, because I can't imagine my life without it.
That's perfect. But actually, The Archers and Radio 4 listening, I think, is often a thing that's inherited. Mm. You learn it from your parents. So was your mum an Archers listener, or is she?
Definitely. My mum, it makes me think of my mum in the kitchen, sort of cooking dinner, and The Archers would be on. And then I remember when I went off to university when I was 18, I would secretly listen to it, because I used to, you know, I'd be like, oh, she's listening to The Archers, you know, moaning about it. And then when I went off to university, because when I went to university in the sort of mid-90s, the internet hadn't quite taken off yet. And, you know, we didn't have mobile phones and stuff. And so my sort of connection to home was to listen to The Archers every day. But I used to listen to it in secret. Like, there's no way I could tell my fellow students that I was sneaking off to listen to The Archers at 7 o'clock every night. But I would. I'd sit in my little room in halls with my little radio and listen to The Archers. And it was just my little connection to home.
Yeah,
you know.
Lovely.
And I remember I was in my 20s, and I had this boyfriend who, it turned out, also listened to The Archers. And we were like, oh, it's our guilty secret. Like, we've got this. It's not just me. I thought I was the only person my age who listened to it. And then, of course, now with podcasts and the internet and everything else, you're like, oh, my God, everyone. There's a whole world of fandom for The Archers. Mm. And I love Archers fans because they're all bonkers, like all of them. We all love those characters. We get angry with the script writers. I just love the whole world of it.
Oh, how have you coped with lockdown, Archers?
Well, I'm, you know, only 4 days a week. So it's during the last year lockdown, when they did the monologues, I know a lot of people moaned and complained it wasn't the same. And you're like, well, of course it's not the same, but it's, you know, Blitz Spirit people, come on. And I think the actors did their best. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, because I had to host a series of the News Quiz in lockdown, you know, on Zoom last year.
Yeah.
And we were getting people going, oh, I don't like what they've done with the News Quiz. It's like, well, it's not our choice to do this. You know, it wasn't an artistic choice to do it without an audience on the internet. You know, I would much rather be in the radio theatre than have been sat doing it in my living room, you know, but that was what we were dealing with. And I think actually the script writers, the actors and everything all sort of pulled together, and the fact they managed to put anything out at all, I think is a testament to how good they are. So, I can't wait for Friday night episodes to come back, because I keep forgetting, and I turn the radio on at 7 o'clock on a Friday, and
I know it's still weird, isn't it? I have to say, there was a period of my life where suddenly I became interesting to a group of women of a certain age, and they would basically ask me, they would say, do the voice. And it's because I played a character in The Archers.
Who did you play in The Archers? You were
I was Paul, Lillian's lover.
Lillian's Paul. You were Paul. Oh my goodness, no, I don't think I knew that. You were Lillian's Paul who died.
Yeah.
Well, wow, that's just, but you don't look like
no,
him.
No, I know. I'm so sorry to spoil it. I know, he's a big swarthy man, isn't he?
That is the thing with The Archers. I hate, like, I quite often now get to, like, I do podcasts and things about The Archers, and I quite often get to meet the actors. Mm. And while it's really nice to meet them, it's always like, but you don't look like...
No.
You don't look like them. It's not right. They're in my head.
No, I know. Well, that's why people wanted me to do the voice, because I didn't look anything like Paul would look, because he was a builder. He was a big, strong, you know, gnarled hand man, the sort of man that some women have an idea it might be interesting to go to bed with.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of going to bed with Lillian.
Yes.
And they basically wanted me to just go deep and quiet and just be a bit sort of rough.
Idea that was you. That's so funny.
It was a very strange experience.
I'm fueling all these middle-aged women's fantasies. Brilliant. Good job if you can get it, I say.
Anyway, that's it. And I have to say, I had a brilliant time doing The Archers. It was lovely fun. And the people on it are really lovely.
Yeah.
It's a complete family. And I was sad to leave it. Sunny, who plays Lillian, is just one of the most gorgeous women you'd ever meet.
Oh, I'm dying to meet her. We have little Twitter exchanges, me and Sunny, but one day I'll get to meet her in real life. But I really want to go. But in fact, before lockdown happened, and they invited me to the studio, and then of course lockdown and everything. But I will get along to the studio and meet some of the actors. And Kerry Davies, one of the writers, you know, I'm forever sort of nagging him that he should write me a little part.
Yeah.
You know, just one day. Come on, Kerry.
When's the Cockney girl coming in? Come on.
Exactly, right? Come on.
Bit of estuary. That's what you need.
I could be one of like Jazza's exes turn up or I love the character of Jazza. And now that Jazza, spoiler alert to anyone who's not caught up, but now that Jazza and Tracy Horribin have got together. Mm. Ah, best. Brilliant.
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 And hopefully that's his future secured. He's got another 30 years there.
Yep. Yes.
So we should expand it. I mean, what a thrill, though, for you, if you are a Radio 4 fan, to then actually get on to the News Quiz, but then be asked to host it. Fantastic.
It was it sounds so corny to say it was a dream come true, but I grew up listening to the News Quiz with my dad. And particularly for me, the person I always talk about who really was a biggest influence on me was Linda Smith. Because she was also a girl from Kent and, you know, politically we're quite similar. But she was the first voice I heard on Radio 4, definitely in Radio 4 comedy, that wasn't a posh bloke, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah.
You know, because you heard women's voices, but they tended to either be posh or if they weren't posh, they were bit parts in sitcoms. Mm. They were playing the cleaning lady or they were playing that, you know. To have a woman being herself with an accent like mine and being clever and funny and holding her own, you go, oh, this isn't just for those other people. This is for me as well. I can do this, you know. Because I'm a firm believer in you have to see it to be it, you know. And so for Linda Smith was that sort of her and Jeremy Hardy together. Well, sadly, I never got to work with Linda. But I did get to work with Jeremy and it was, I couldn't believe my luck. And I remember what happened, it was 10 years ago now, I won the BBC New Comedy Award.
Yeah.
Like a stand-up competition. And I did an interview for a magazine after I won it. Or it might have been when I was just in the final or something. Mm. And they said, what's your biggest comedy ambition? And I said, to be on the News Quiz. That was my biggest comedy ambition. I was like, I just want to be on the News Quiz. And Victoria Lloyd was producing it at the time and she got in touch with me on Facebook, believe it or not. At this point, I didn't have an agent or anything at this point. And she said, I read your interview. She said, would you like to come in and do a day's writing on the News Quiz? You know, come write Sandy's script. So I was like, what? I could not believe my luck. So yeah, I went in, I did that a few times. And then eventually they asked me to be on it a few years later. And then last year, I was lucky enough to host a series.
It's amazing.
Yeah, a really amazing. Like, I still can't quite get my head around that I did it.
It's wonderful that the producers, that she sees that change as possible. So many people think if you've got a thing, you can't really change fundamentally the style of it.
Yeah.
And it has for many, many years been presented by posh blokes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are many more opportunities now than there ever were for people who aren't, you know, posh white men. Mm-hmm. You know, no offence to the posh white men, but that's all you heard on Radio 4 for decades.
Yeah, that's why I ended up speaking like this.
Yeah.
I taught myself to be a posh white man.
I say, in my family, they call me the posh one. That's worrying, isn't it?
You learn to make yourself understood.
Well, yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so to be on Radio 4 was something I never thought would be something I could do, you know, and now... Yeah, it's brilliant. I love it. I love it. It feels like home, Radio 4. I have a very big place in my heart for it. And I hope it survives. I really do.
Well, then, in that case, just for you, I shall have Sailing By playing in the background.
Oh, lovely. That's the other thing. I used to, when I was a student, I used to listen to the shipping forecast to get to sleep.
Oh, perfect. Well, then all of Radio 4 will go into the time capsule for you.
Great.
Right. Angie, what's next?
Okay, my next one, I can actually grab and show you, but give me just a sec.
Mm.
I am showing you a bottle.
Perfect.
Of something called Screech Rum, Newfoundland Screech Rum. And the reason I've chosen this is, so my family on my mum's side are from Newfoundland.
Oh.
Which is a little island on the east coast of Canada. Mm-hmm. And when you visit Newfoundland, you have to go through a process called being screeched in. And being screeched in involves drinking a shot of screech rum,
mm-hmm.
eating a cube of what they call Newfie steak, which is spam, essentially.
Yeah.
and kissing a cod. And once you've done those three things and recited a little poem, you've been screeched in and you're an honorary Newfoundlander.
So a nicer version of the ceremony to become a member of the Bullingdon Club then.
Exactly, that sort of thing. A sort of like the British identity test, but, you know, with booze. It's great. And it represents really the whole of, this is my mum's, my mum is one of nine children. Mm-hmm. And I have 40-something first cousins. It's a big old family. And a lot of them live in Newfoundland. Most of them live here. But I thought growing up that everybody's family was full of musicians and had big parties. and I didn't realise that my family was quite unique in that they're performers. I'm the quiet one. I'm the sort of reserved one. And I'm the only one who doesn't really sing or play a musical instrument. But the rest of my family do. And they get together and the guitars come out and they jam. And they're just fun. And their sort of currency of talking to each other in my mum's family is jokes. It's making each other laugh. And that's definitely where, you know, I got my sort of comedy roots are in my mum's family, my Newfoundland family and here. So I just wanted something in the time capsule to sort of encompass all of that, and nothing better than a bottle of screech rum.
Absolutely. Screech rum. I quite fancy some now. Isn't Newfoundland, though, when English people make jokes about people who are not very bright, traditionally they make jokes about Irish people. I mean, completely unfair.
Yep.
My father used to tell an Irish joke and I liked it because it sort of turned the thing on its head, which was a girl said, would you like to paint me nude? And he said, is it all right if I keep my socks on? And she said, why? He said, so I can have somewhere to stick my brushes. But is that not the case for people who live in Newfoundland? Aren't they the people who traditionally are the source of those sort of jokes?
Absolutely. To other Canadians, if you say, oh, my mum's family are Newfies, they go, oh, God. Yeah, they live on the rock, they're in the Newfies. It's a mad place, Newfoundland, in the most beautiful way. It's the size of England and Wales, but there's only 500,000 people live there. And it is beautiful. And because it's a very ruggedy coastline, so it's all bays and just beautiful little bays and things. And I went to the little village where my granddad was brought up, and it's a little place called Ship Harbour. And it's called Ship Harbour, interestingly, because it's where Roosevelt and Churchill signed the NATO agreement on the ship in that bay.
Oh.
So there's a little fact for you.
Yeah. See, we're not just funny, we're educational as well.
When you're not laughing, you're learning. That's what I say. And I went there with my fella and my cousin Dot as well. And we went into this shop. And in Ship Harbour, this little village where my granddad's from, has a population of about 200 people. And in those 200 people, there are two surnames. And those surnames are Griffiths and Griffin. So I think it's fair to say the gene pool, more of a puddle there.
Yes.
And my grandfather's name was Griffiths. That's my mum's maiden name. And we went into the local store and I got chatting to a guy in there. I was sort of telling him about my granddad. And I said, so I think that makes us cousins. And he just looked at me and he went, we're all cousins here. Oh, yeah, that's where,
yep.
That's where I am. And you sort of walk around Ship Harbour and I was like, oh, they all look a bit like us. Ah. I was like walking through a hall of mirrors. It's like, oh, there's a fat me and there's a thin me. But I love it there. It's one of the, they really pride themselves on their hospitality in Newfoundland. And there's the story, I don't know if you know the story of the musical Come From Away.
It's the aeroplanes, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So there's a big international airport in Newfoundland because before planes could make it all the way across the Atlantic, that would be a refueling stop.
Mm.
So they had this big international airport and, of course, all the planes were grounded in 9/11. So suddenly all these thousands of people were marooned in Newfoundland. And the Newfoundlanders, being Newfoundlanders, took them all in, fed them, had parties, screeched them all in. And the people had such a good time that they set up like a trust fund for the children of Gander, of this city in Newfoundland, paying for their education. So they have a college fund now.
Wow, wonderful.
That the people from those planes set up for the kids in that community because of how well they sort of treated them when they were stranded. So it's a really lovely story. But they are like that. They'll just take anyone in and they just want to feed you. I mean, we always put on weight when we go there, sort of come back. And it's all the food is sort of salt and fat and things because their winters are so harsh, you know, it's all, they're all built to take it. But we go there and eat it and I sort of come home two stone heavier.
But with a bottle of Screech rum.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such a great place. And it's very Irish influence. In St. John's, in the main city, the main drag, if you like, George Street, is just full of Irish bars and the music sounds like Irish music. My granddad, who lived over here, everyone thought was Irish. Very odd accent, but yeah, it's very Irish. It's a great place and people don't really go there.
No, it does sound like a place to visit. It's never, ever occurred to me that I might go to Newfoundland.
When we go there with our English accents, they're not used to hearing English accents there, because I think Canadians go there on holiday because it's beautiful, but other people don't really. I think they've had a bit of tourism boost from the whole come from away thing. Mm. I think that helped a bit. And it's such a beautiful place as well. And yeah, I love it there. Just lots of beautiful little villages and it's gorgeous. I really recommend it as a holiday destination. I'm putting it on the map, Newfoundland. Although in the winters, it's, don't go in the winter. It's pretty. My grandmother, my granddad came here during the war. He was with the Newfoundland Regiment and met my grandma and they got married during the war here. Mm. And then after the war, they went to Newfoundland and she went back on the Queen Margaret, the Queen Mary, rather, the cruise liner, which was being used as a troop ship. Mm. So she went back on that with all the troops going back and she was 8 months pregnant on that voyage. So she had an awful time. And this was in 1946, I think this was. And they arrive in Nova Scotia and then she has to get on another rickety little boat to Newfoundland. And it's winter and she's a girl from Kent, you know. And of course, it's in 1946 in winter in Newfoundland. She's 8 months pregnant. And yeah, it was a bit of a culture shock for my grandmother, I think.
Yeah, what have I done?
You know, and when she went to labour, they had to dig through the snow to get her to the hospital. And so in the end, they came back to England. She just got really homesick. She was there for a few years. I think I had a couple of her kids there. Mm. And then, yeah, just couldn't deal with the winters at all.
Back to Maidstone.
Well, Swanley, even worse.
Swanley.
But yeah.
Well, Screech rum. You sort of go, well, I think I know what this is going to taste like if it's called Screech rum.
I don't think I've ever drunk it when I've been sober to start with. I don't think I have.
Brilliant. Well, that's safely inside your time capsule.
Lovely.
Lovely. So that's your second item in there, safely. What's number three? Okay, I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. We're going to take a short ad break now, but we'll be back in a jiffy.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right, well, welcome back.
That's not a good idea, was it, getting in a jiffy bag? Anyway, before it gets embarrassing, let's return to Angela Barnes and the things she wants to preserve in her time capsule.
Okay, number three is, it sounds like it's going to get a bit slushy here, and it isn't.
Okay.
But it's my engagement ring I'm putting in. So I'm hopefully getting married in September. I say hopefully because of, you know, COVID and everything, who knows at the minute, but that's the plan. Mm-hmm. And my engagement ring, I'm showing it to you on the Zoom there. It's a bit unusual in that it's a square of concrete. I don't know if you can see that. So I don't really do dainty jewellery, but I love concrete. I love brutalist architecture and I have an obsession with nuclear bunkers. And in fact, you're looking at my wall here. You can probably see there's a cross section of two nuclear bunkers on my framed on my wall there. And it's just, I always say to people, I'm not a communist, but I really like the look. Like I love those sort of Soviet concrete structures and things. So my fella, when he proposed, he got me a concrete engagement ring.
Fantastic.
So I love that it sort of represents sort of my love of all those things, but also my relationship as well. You know, with we've been together 7 years now, but we're getting married this year. It's a lot going on in that little ring.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You must be furious when the wall went down in Berlin.
Oh, absolutely.
What are they doing? You vandals.
It's funny because I do a history podcast with John O'Farrell.
I know.
And I take the mickey out of him quite a lot because he's got an authentic piece of the Berlin Wall. And I always say to him, well, how do you know it's authentic? You know, like if everyone who said they had an authentic piece of the Berlin Wall actually did, there would have been a lot more Berlin Wall than there was.
You think there's a whole industry then of people knocking concrete to pieces, then spray painting one side of it?
Put a bit of graffiti on it, done.
Yeah.
The Berlin Wall actually came down on my 13th birthday. I remember it because I was learning German at school and my German teacher obviously was telling us all about what was happening as it was happening. And 9th of November 1989 was my 13th birthday.
What a brilliant way to remember something. You could really fool people into the fact that you were brilliant at dates, couldn't you? Just go, well, you know, I remember all sorts of dates, like Berlin Wall, 9th of November.
1989, yeah.
I won't bother with any others, but, you know, I've got them all there somewhere in the back of my head. So would you like to live in a nuclear bunker?
No.
No.
I'm having my hen do in one, interestingly. In genuinely true, in Dundee, there's so it's the Royal Observer Corps headquarters in Dundee. My friend Gavin is the manager of it, and it's got dormitories in there. It's quite a big underground bunker. Mm. And so we're going up there for a weekend in July, me and some girlfriends, and we're going to hang out in a nuclear bunker for the weekend.
Well,
why not?
Let's hope it's not perfect timing. That's all I can say.
Exactly.
For the sake of the rest of us.
It's funny, I've got a WhatsApp group with my friends that are coming on the hen do, and we were making all the arrangements, and my friend said, oh, it's going to be a blast. I said, well, if it is, we're in the right place. It's fine.
I have seen nuclear bunkers for sale, though. Mm. I saw one advertised quite recently.
Yeah.
And it was huge.
Yeah.
It had loads of rooms, but all underground, so all without any light.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Cold War ones are the ones I'm sort of a bit nerdy about. And there are 1,500 of them in this country.
Wow.
But most of them are very small, what they call Royal Observer Corps posts, so little three-man bunkers. But then you have the massive ones are the ones that would have been are called regional seats of government. So in the event of a nuclear war, in the Cold War, the I mean, I won't nerd on about this too much because I could.
Go on. I like it.
The government would disband into 12 regions and there would be non-elected commissioner appointed for each region. And each region had its own command bunker. There's one in Essex called Kelvedon Hatch, which you can go and visit. And there's one in Cheshire called Hack Green that you can go and visit. And one in Fife in Scotland, Anstruther. I mean, these ones are huge, really massive, like sleep 400 people, you know, and the idea being that in the event of nuclear war, this is where you would sort of try and restart society from. Luckily, we never needed them, but not yet, anyway.
It's a fairly optimistic view of a nuclear war, isn't it? Give it a couple of weeks and we'll get going again.
Well, I think in the 50s, when these were starting to be built, you know, you were looking at sort of bombs that were Hiroshima scale or twice that, three times. Now you're looking at, you know, it's just pointless even trying to survive a nuclear blast with the weapons that exist now. Mm. And I think you ask anyone that sort of own these bunkers, I talked to my friend Gavin about it and said, you know, well, at least you've got that if the worst does happen. You know, you own a bunker. And he was like, if the worst happened, I'm running towards ground zero. I don't want to live my days out in there.
No.
I think I'd rather be a goner than survive.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a nuclear Holocaust survivor.
Although I slightly suspect that you're not telling us this, but that ring, you are nuclear girl. With a blast, you just hold the ring towards the explosion. And it would just, you'd battle against it, but no, you'd
damn it, he's on to me. I thought I'd been so covert and subtle.
You've had this power, you've just never had the chance to use it. Yes.
Right.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, then that ring is important for all of us, important for mankind.
Absolutely, yes.
And I have to say, it's beautiful. It's really
Thank
beautiful.
You. Yes, I really love it.
Okay, we'll put it safely in the time capsule for you then.
Wonderful.
So, number four.
Number four. Okay, number four is a 7-inch single of, and I was going to dig it out and show it so I could show it to you, but it's in the loft and I haven't gone up there. But it's Isn't She Lovely, which is the, it was a Stevie Wonder song, but it was covered by a man called Dave Parton in Britain in the 70s. I don't know who Dave Parton was.
No.
But I've got the single because my dad bought it on the day I was born.
Oh.
And because it's a song about a newborn baby girl. And the story goes that, so I was born prematurely and he got the call that I was on my way early. So he got in his car. And as he was driving to the hospital, this song came on the radio. And so he stopped at a Woolworths and bought it. Because he was like, well, there's a 50-50 chance it's going to be a girl. So, so he bought the single for Woolworths. And then went up to when I was born, and I've still got it. So that was 1976.
Oh, how beautiful.
Yeah, and it's really, my dad's no longer with us. My dad died in 2008, and he died before I started doing stand-up and comedies. So all the stuff I do on Radio 4 and everything that I used to listen to with my dad, he never got to see me do that. Which is, you know, it's why it'll always be tinged with sadness. All the stuff that I get to do now is always tinged a little bit with sadness.
And was he encouraging you to do that?
Very much so. So he was, so what happened with me, I loved comedy, but I just never thought it was something I could do, you know, and I didn't do my first open spot until after my dad, it was because my dad died really.
Right.
That I went, you know, life's short. And so I was 33 when I did my first gig. But my dad was, he just loved comedy. And I used to run a comedy night just in a room above a pub in Brighton where I live, because just because I loved comedy and I loved watching live comedy. And he used to come every week to it. And he used to say, you know, why don't you get up and have a go? And I used to do things like, I used to be in an Amdram group and do bits and bobs of, you know, that sort of thing. But I'd never done any proper performing. And go, why don't you have a go? And I was like, don't be stupid. I can't, you can't just get up and do it, Dad. Don't be stupid, you know. And then when he died, I was like, oh, do you know what? You can just get up and do it. You can.
Yeah.
And you should, you know. And I did a stand-up comedy course. I did the Jill Edwards course at Comedia.
Comedia, the same as Sean Walsh?
Same course that Sean Walsh did, exactly. Mm. Yes, I did. Quite a few. Jimmy Carr did that course and Simon Evans did it. Quite a few comics have done it. Because I just felt I needed to sort of, I didn't, also because I booked comedians for comedy nights, I knew a lot of them, so I didn't want to get up in front of them and be shit. I was like, I need to work out if I can do this first. So I did the course.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, so that was 2009 I did the course. And then I did my first open spot properly in 2010. So yeah, it's been a bit of a mad sort of 10 years really.
And straight in as best newcomer.
Well, sort of, yeah, fairly quickly, which was, that was the kind of moment where it's like, oh, maybe this can, because I was still working full time then, you know, and I was like, oh, maybe this can be my job. Maybe
And it is.
Yeah. The rest, as they say. It is. And I still have to pinch myself. I still can't quite believe that I get away with it, Mike. But, you know, all the while they keep giving me work, I'll keep taking it.
I'm going to go and do that course at the Comedia.
Yeah, do it. It's great.
It's what a hit rate, though.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, she's brilliant. Jill, I love Jill Edwards. She's, what she does in the, because people say, you know, can courses teach you to be a stand-up comic? And I don't know. They can't teach everyone to be. I think you need to have it in you.
Yeah.
But I think what they can do is iron out some bad habits early on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just little things like, you know, learning how to stand on a stage. Because when you go and watch an open mic night, you'll see people are fiddling with a mic cable and they're nervous and they won't look you in the eye. And they're, you know, all those little tricks into how to look confident and look like a performer.
Stagecraft, really.
Yeah, exactly that. And also just little, she does sort of writing exercises and things just to get you started. Because when you first sit down to write comedy, you're like, well, I've got the whole world I can write about. Where do I start? You know, and she gives you this, these little exercises, just things to get you going. I say it's like going to an art class, you know, you can't be Picasso until you've learned the basics. You know, you can't just go and... So what she gives you is the tool. She teaches you the basics of joke writing and stagecraft, and then you do with that what you want to do with that.
Yes. So your first one, you sat down, a newfie goes into a bar. No, start again. I have enormous admiration for people who take that risk and do stand on that stage for the first time and just start talking to a group of people and think, you know, I hope you find this funny. I think it's quite funny.
People think it's a brave thing. And I always say, I think it's the opposite of brave. So I once was emceeing a gig in a rugby club or something. When you're emceeing, you know, you chat to the audience a bit. And I was chatting to a guy in the front row who was a paramedic. And we were having a little chat. And in the break, he said, oh, can I buy you a drink? And he bought me a drink and he said, you're so brave. And I was like, no. No. You're a paramedic. You turn up to accidents. I'm not the brave one in this. You're like, I'm a show-off is what I am. Mm-hmm. You're brave. Because I'm quite an anxious person in life. I think people are surprised by that. I think people often think that comedians are sort of full of supreme self-confidence because you'd have to be. Mm. But actually, I think it's the opposite in a way, because I know that when I'm on a stage with a microphone in my hand, it's always my turn to talk. I'm not talking over anyone. I'm not having to worry about the sort of social niceties and all of that. You know, it's just like I can just stand there, do what I've got to do, and I feel safer there than I do, say, you know, in a pub with people I've not met before, or at a party talking to someone new or whatever. I find that much more nerve-wracking than standing on a stage with a microphone. It's nervous the first time you do it, obviously, and it takes a while to get, but once you sort of get over that, I find it's my sort of happy place now. It's where I feel most me, I think.
When I've seen it, particularly playing a small room, where you think, that joke's worth more than that. Mm. That response was, you know, minimal. Come on now, make an effort. I am the sort of person you should have in an audience. If ever I go to a stand-up thing, people always say, you, mate, you can come again. I'm paying for you to come again. If I just laugh, and I laugh loudly.
You are the dream. Because some people, bless them, they don't laugh loudly. They're enjoying themselves, but they just don't make a noise, which is no good to us.
No.
No good to us at all. I do think comedians and performers make good audiences because we know what it's like to be up there. I know when we're getting married in September, and my fella's best man is quite nervous because he's got to do a speech, and obviously there'll be quite a lot of comedians there.
Yeah.
And I had to say to him, don't be nervous about that. No. They'll be the best audience you could have because they will get it and they will laugh at anything that sounds like it might be a joke.
Yeah.
Because they will know.
Yeah. I mean, God, this bloke doesn't even do it professionally and he's told something that is reasonably funny.
Exactly.
That is worth a belly laugh.
Exactly. Honestly, don't be put off by the fact there'll be comedians there because he was a bit like, oh God, I've got to do a speech in front of comics. But yeah, it's not a stand-up night, it's a wedding, it's fine. They're not going to be expecting you to, you know, zing every line. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And also, I told him he's not allowed to be funnier than my speech anyway, so it's fine.
Oh, that's really lovely, though. Okay, well, yes, then we only have one more item to put into your time capsule, I'm sad to say.
So this is the item that I want to put in that I'm happy to see the back of, right?
Mm.
So possibly slightly controversial here, but I would like to put my womb in there. several reasons. Mostly in that I am child-free by choice is what I like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now at an age, so I'm nearly 45. So I'm at an age now where people have stopped asking me about whether or not I'm going to have kids. I think they mostly assume that I can't have kids, which isn't the truth. I've just chosen not to. But during my 30s, it drove me insane, this sort of pressure that is on women of a certain age to be a parent. And men get the pressure as well, but it's different because they haven't got the clock running down that we've got, you know.
Mm.
And I'm now at a stage of my life where I've got, they call it the perimenopause, which is the bit before the menopause, where I say it's like my reproductive system sort of handed its notice in and is just coasting till it can retire, you know.
Yeah, the perimenopause makes me always think of, you know, in a packet of Rizzlers, you may not know this, but in a packet of Rizzlers, when you get five Rizzlers from the end, it says a little card comes out that says there's only five papers left. And and that's sort of where
there's
you
only
are.
Five eggs left.
You've only, you know, not many to go. You know.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. I've probably got more hairs on my chin than viable eggs in my womb now. That's why. That's the stage of life I'm at. It's really fun, Mike.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I have never had the calling to be a mother. And I know like throughout my 30s, people were giving it the, you know, it'll come. And I was like, I don't think it will. And it never did. And I always say to people, I do understand biological urges. It's just that mine are for carbs and babies are protein based. So I've never been interested. And I just, now I sort of am at a point where, you know, talking to doctors about it before, a friend of mine had real sort of problems and asked if she could have a hysterectomy in her 30s. And the doctors absolutely refused because she hadn't had kids and she didn't want kids. And they said to her, you know, how can you be sure your family's complete? And she said, I know my family's complete because I've got a dog. That was her answer. But, you know, it's this idea that women don't know their own minds until it's too late. And I find that offensive. You know, I knew at 30 that I didn't want kids, but there's this narrative that, you know, one day you'll wake up and you'll have changed your mind.
And you came from a large family. You're bound to want one yourself.
Exactly. You know, I do think part of it is because I was 12 when my brother was born. His name's Philip, but I like to call him Whoops. I was 12 and I remember really vividly what it was like having a newborn baby in the house. And I'm sure that's why I've never romanticized it. I've never sort of, because I was old enough to go, this is hell.
Yeah.
Like, and he was a particularly, I get on really well with my brother now and he's the most lovely, placid soul. But my God, he was a nightmare child. Like just a hyperactive, you know, didn't ever sleep. And it was hell. And I think that's why I've gone, yeah, I'm not buying into that.
No.
And it was things like the sort of repetition of parenthood, the kind of, you know, having to read the same stories over again and all of that stuff just never appealed to me.
No. And the whole process of menopause and all those things, they happen to women at very different ages. Some people go into the menopause very young. And quite often they're people who are going, oh, no, I really wanted children.
Yeah.
And it's not happened for them. And then other people,
it can take so long. And it's such a, I just think if this stuff happened to men, it would have all been sorted out by now. Do you know what I mean? It would, wouldn't it?
There would be a pill.
There would be a pill you could take that would just be like, there you go, it's over. Because I think, I mean, menopause has such horrific symptoms. Horrific. And of course, we don't talk about it. And, you know, because I mean, it only affects over half the population. Why would we be open and talk about it? You know.
And of course, if it was happening to men, the men who said, well, I'm not going to have children, I'm going to dedicate myself to my career, they would be the heroes.
Absolutely. Whereas we're seen as being some sort of evil witches. And I just think, how's that the selfish act? Surely it'd be more selfish if I brought a child into the world that I didn't want. Surely that would be a worse thing to do. And this sort of idea as well that because I don't have children and I don't want children of my own, that I must hate children. You know, that's a really weird conclusion to come to. Like, I love donkeys. I don't want one in my house. I love playing with my friends' kids. I love babies. I love smelling babies. I love all of that. I've just never wanted one of my own. And I have a dog, and that's taken care of any maternal instincts that I might have had.
Well, it means that you've picked up poo.
Yeah, tick that box. Yeah. It's fine. And I just would like people to stop asking people whether or not they're going to have kids like it's small talk, because it's not. And actually, I find it, I mean, for me, it was always easy to answer because the truth is I don't want kids and that's fine. But if you can't have kids or you desperately do want kids and you can't have kids, how awful to be constantly being asked about when you're going to start a family, as if it's anyone else's business.
Yeah.
You know, if it's something that you're trying to do and it's not happening for you or whatever, I can't, because that's the other thing as well. People think that I've got no sympathy for those people. Of course I have. And I feel guilty that I probably could have had a family and didn't. You know, I said to my friend, I was like, maybe if I'd thought about it earlier, I could have looked into surrogacy or something, you know. But now, I mean, no one's going to want to put all their eggs in my old basket now, that's for sure. But it's cruel. It's cruel. We're one of the few creatures, humans, where women have an end to their fertility that's long before they die, you know. And it just seems a sort of cruel twist of nature, that.
Yes, and then also the other side of it, that once you can't have children, you're sort of in a way regarded as not worth anything now.
Mm.
It's an astonishing thing, isn't it?
People look at you like you're a waiter in Nando's. Like, what are you for? Why are you here? You've got no purpose anymore. Get out. We just very rarely see in drama or anything representations of couples that are happy not having children, didn't want to. And I know that's because that's the dramatic tension. It's always one of them wants kids and the other one doesn't. But I just like to see us represented sometimes, because I live in Brighton and it's, I've got lots of friends my age who don't want kids, never had kids. It's more common than people think. if you want children, and then that's great. And you should be encouraged to, if you've got love to give, there's kids that need love, right?
Yeah. But then you must have lots of friends who have children. And I bet they think that you're the naughty auntie.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. My sort of best friend, maid of honour, Kirsten, she's got three kids. And one of them's now 16, so he's allowed to watch me on telly now. But the two younger ones, like when I do things like Mock the Week or whatever, because it can get a bit fruity. So they're allowed to watch me, but with the sound off. They just like to know that I'm on the telly, but they don't. They're not allowed to listen to what I say yet.
And when will they be allowed to come and see you live?
Oh, well, I don't know about that. I think the older one's been, actually. They've brought the older one now, so he's been. But the two younger ones, soon, I hope.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
Their mum's a primary school teacher, so I think she keeps them in check. But don't worry, they've got Auntie Angie to lead them astray. Don't worry about that.
Well, yes, then I shall take... This now sounds like a really weird thing to say. But I shall, Angie, take your womb.
You're welcome to it. I have no more use for it.
And I'm going to tuck it away in a cupboard at the back of the time capsule. We'll all just feel sorry for you.
Yeah, it's terribly sad, isn't it? It's terribly sad.
Oh, Angie, it's been really lovely. Thank you so much for giving up your time to do this. It's really nice to talk to you.
Total pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been really fun. I'm so excited when you asked me to do it because I've been listening to them. So, yes, thank you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule, hosted by me, Mike Fenton-Stevens. My guest was Angela Barnes. If you've not subscribed to My Time Capsule yet, please do, as it really helps us. And don't forget to rate the show on the podcast provider you prefer. We use Acast, but it's up to you. You may also get the chance to write a short review, which we also really appreciate. To find out what's happening and who our upcoming guests are, you could follow me or My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook. You just search Fenton Stevens or My TC Pod. You can download or stream the theme tune, written by Pass the Peas Music, on Spotify. This was a cast-off production for Acast. The producer was John Fenton Stevens. Right, I've been sitting here in front of this mic far too long. Time for some exercise. I'll just put my running shoes on. No, can't catch them. I'll tell you what, I'll put my normal shoes on. There we go. Oh, they're a bit tight. Yeah, perhaps I should try it with the tongue out. No, that makes no difference at all. Oh, well, perhaps I'll just stay here and listen to another episode of My Time Capsule. Oh, now there's a great idea. Yeah, I wonder if anyone will actually fall for that. I mean, it's hardly subliminal, is it? Oh, well, where are my slippers? There we go. Oh, so that's why they call them slippers. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.